Was it on the bullets or on the cartridges?
I believe
Do
it
you
was
know?
on the shells of the bullets.
On the shelves. So
The
it took all this
shells.
trouble. So it took all this trouble to engrave words that never even went to their target.
Exactly.
All
So,
right.
yeah, but let's talk about that. And I also, a lot have been reporting done is about how Charlie Kirk had this has this huge organization, and I was very supportive of Charlie Kirk in the sense of getting people to talk. Let's get people to talk, like what we're doing, and let's find some answers. Change my mind, Alex, type thing. Andy, change my mind. And that's what Charlie would do. Let's talk. And then he was taken out. And he became very critical of Israel, and especially specifically Netanyahu. Go ahead and give me your thoughts.
Well, I think that it's hard to avoid the conclusion that this is a cover-up, that he was taken out by supporters of Israel. But let's put it this way, Andy. At this point, it doesn't even matter whether that's true or not. What matters is the conviction that is forming in the court of public opinion. Because it seems to me that more and more people are inclined to believe that Israel was behind his assassination for a whole host of reasons. And I think that's possible. And you know, like if you were a novice crime investigator and you look at everything that presents itself to you, you would have to say, well, I think that this is top of the list of suspects to my mind, and it will be Israel, or it will be Israeli supporters in the United States, or one of these organizations that are, Zionist agents in the United States. And it seems to me, well, you know, maybe we'll never know because this is one of those heavy-duty political assassinations that even the people in power might not like us to know too much about. So, you know, it might end up like JFK assassination and RFK assassination and MLK assassination that, you know, people are going to do research, people.
Alex Craner, good morning. I should say good evening to you, my friend. How are you?
I'm well. Good to be with you again, Andy. And so far, so good. Everything's okay.
Yeah, right. And Alex, it's really good to be with you and to all my viewers and listeners. Alex, I've said this, I don't want to embarrass you, Alex, but you're literally I have a handful of go-to people. You are at the very top of that list. I also get so many requests from you and for you to have you on. And these are the times that I like and enjoy talking with you to hopefully shed some light, a little bit of light on what's going on in the world. So to recap, this is we just had the death of Charlie Kirk, the murder, assassination, and I don't say this lightly, whatever you want to call that. We had all of these tensions here with Israel, and I believe the Kirk camp that's starting to come out here. And then in also the previous week, I want to say, and I hope I get my timeline right, you had the French government more or less implode. You had some serious demonstrations, for lack of a better word, and things are getting very interesting in the UK when we've talked about that over the last several months. And then you had, I want to say, seven deaths. Or you can call it potential assassinations in Germany in the right wing party. I don't know exactly where to start, but is this all related? What's going on? Are things getting desperate and things are definitely getting interesting?
I would say it's all very definitely related. And I might take a risk of sounding like a broken record, but I think it's extremely important to keep in mind that this is the conflict between two systems of governance, as George Soros warned us, which, you know, I made up my mind. It's not really two systems of governance. it's really one system of governance against everybody else. And that one system is related to the money lending oligarchies in the West. And it's a colonialist, imperialistic system of governance, which has had its its unipolar moment. It's scrambling to get it back, to salvage it, which pretty much means bludgeoning everybody else into submission, because empires don't tolerate rivals. We know this through history. We had Rome, which couldn't rest until it completely destroyed Carthage, because it could not stand another power in the Mediterranean that potentially could rival them. And so empires don't share the world. They go to for total conquest or failure. And so far in history, every empire has failed, and so will this one. But I think that right now it's fighting for survival, and the result is a global total war, not only against nations like Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela, and others, but also the populations of the nations that are in this imperial camp, primarily Britain and France, but also Germany. And then, to an extent, other nations are in its orbit, like Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Poland, Finland, Japan, Singapore, And so everywhere where the empire is challenged, it attacks. So we have the war against Russia by proxy through Ukraine. We have a war on Iran by proxy through Israel, and all other nations that aspire to challenge the empire, what we might call the axis of resistance. So Yemen, Hezbollah, Hamas, and so forth. And in the near future, they clearly want to take on China, but the Project Ukraine is not going so well, and neither is the war on Iran. So they're backed up a little bit. And then as the empire's economies are in a rapid state of disintegration. When I say the empire, let's call it also the rules-based global order, as they like to call it. But it's the nations that are in the Western EU NATO camp, so France and Germany and so forth. So as their economies are disintegrating, there are increasing social pressures. People demanding change, radical change, and the ruling establishment not willing to yield. So they're responding with repression, with heavy-handed censorship, with arrests, with beatings, and with assassinations. It's nothing new. This has been happening for centuries. It may be new in the post-World War II order, but it isn't really. It was just that it's we know more we know more about it today. But we had assassinations over the last few decades. Names that come to mind could be the CEO of Deutsche Bank, Alfred Herrhausen, in 1989. I think one day or just a few days after the Berlin Wall fell, we had the assassination of Italian Prime Minister Aldo Moro, JFK, RFK, and so forth. All these people were looking towards a different path to development of human societies, and they had to be eliminated. And so this is where we are now. We have an AfD party in Germany, which is challenging the status quo. They wanted very badly to outlaw AfD, which apparently is not so easy. So I guess the next plan B would be their representatives, their candidates dropping dead in very difficult to explain circumstances.
Yeah, so let's work that out. So what exactly happened? Just fill in all of our viewers and listeners. What exactly happened in Germany there? And what are the implications? Where do we go from here specifically with Germany? And then let's talk, work out France and then the UK. And then if we have time, we'll work our way to Iran and Israel and the Middle East.
Well, I cannot say exactly what happened in Germany, but they were that's about now or just happened. They had elections in Rhine-Westphalia, and seven of the AfD candidates dropped dead in the space of about 13 days. Which is very strange. You know, you could say, well, there's a lot of candidates, so you know, maybe they just died. But the you
It's
know,
like a
first,
statistical almost impossibility, right? But go ahead.
it's close to it. Yeah, it's close to a statistical impossibility. It's a real challenge for the coincidence theories, I can tell you that. You know, normally people, when they run for office, they tend to be in good health, even if they're, you know, even if they're older, because it's a, you know, it's a grueling process to run election campaigns. And generally people don't vote for sickly, low energy candidates. So
Right.
I didn't know these seven, but I would presume that they were at the very least in an okay state of health. And then somebody ran, you know, an AI check to see if any candidates of any other parties died in this same period, and none died. So, you know, the fact that only just one party's candidates died in such a short interval of time is obviously very, very highly suspicious. But that's all I know, you know. Then there's been a lot of debates, discussions, guesswork, speculation, and so forth. Some people come out at the other end saying, man, no, could happen, you know, not necessarily foul play. Other people say definitely foul play. These were assassinations. There's no chance that this could have happened by chance. We can't know for sure, but it definitely leaves a bad taste in the mouth. And we've already seen that, you know, they attempted to assassinate Robert Fico in Slovakia. I think there have been assassination attempts against Viktor Orban. I'm pretty sure I read reports about threats of assassination in Germany against the AfD candidates in the years past. There's been two assassination attempts against Donald Trump. And maybe there's more, but this is what I know so far. And then all these people have something in common. You know, they are candidates that advocate greater autonomy and sovereignty of individual nations. They want to change the development policy of the nation. They no longer wish to participate or finance or support in any way war in Ukraine. And on and on and on. And so, you know, on the other side, you know, you don't see people like Ursula von der Leyen and Kaja Kallas and Keir Starmer or Radek Sikorski or Friedrich Merz. You don't see any of these people dropping dead. So I think that it's justified to suspect that these are assassinations, which tells you that the imperial cabal is feeling the heat, that they are desperate, that they are losing, and that they're, you know, in the panic mode, trying to reverse their defeat. Is it going to work? I think it largely depends on the United States.
So pin that thought I want to go to that in just a second, but where does this really leave Germany? Because their economy is more or less has been in a rolling recession, if I'm not mistaken, for close to over 2 years now. And the voters were, it seemed like the right where these candidates were from, and I apologize, I don't know their names. I just know that seven people from the party disappeared, more or less, or died. But where does that leave them? I guess Germany, are they going to, you mentioned previously, you think they should push, Germany should push east and form alliances with Russia. Do you think that is still the case? Do you think Germany has any, are they going to still beating the NATO war drum? I mean, yeah, work that out for me.
Well, if we take the long view of history, Germany has tended, particularly in the wake of these crisis periods, to pivot to Russia. And I think that's a very logical tendency because Russia is actually, if you look at the situation today, and particularly from the point of view of an ordinary German, Russia is the most logical partner for Germany, not only as a trade partner but also as a partner in security. To the west, Russia has France and Belgium, which have, had antagonistic relationship with Russia. To the north, they have Denmark, same thing. To the east, they have Poland, same thing. In fact, the Polish government, particularly Radosław Sikorski, who is a through and through a British agent, has explicitly said that his role, their role, the role of the Poles is to antagonize both Russia and Germany. He didn't say this in a speech. He said that in a meeting with another official in Poland, but it was caught in a recording and published by a Polish magazine called Wprost. And so, we know what the mindset is. And so Germany basically finds herself surrounded. And then, there's also the relationship with the British, which are extremely active. They have a military cooperation agreement with Poland and with Denmark and with Sweden and with France. Probably also with Norway. They're kind of surrounded, and their democracy has been eviscerated, and all the growth and development strategies that might have been considered in the since the fall of the Berlin Wall have been shoved aside. And practically since the year 2000, they went towards this insane net zero policy. They started phasing out their nuclear reactors. I think by 22 or 23, 2023, they phased out all of them, every last one of them. They adopted this insanity of solar and wind farms. And as a result, today, Germany, along with Britain, pay the highest energy prices, I think, pretty much in the world, which has rendered their industries completely uncompetitive. And so, as a result, the nation, which was an industrial superpower, has started losing its economic base. And so, from there, you're going towards social uprisings or changing government. But if they won't let you vote in a different government that will, deliver a course change, then all you're left with is a violent change of government. And so, this is where we're going. I don't know what's going to happen because, as flawed as our democracies are, they are to an extent resilient. And so all these people, all these candidates and parties and with their programs, they're not just going to go away because somebody's intimidating them. But if they start being assassinated, like in the 1930s, then you could engineer the rise to power of some insane maniac like Adolf Hitler. Because, bringing Hitler to power was very, very difficult. Everybody knew what he was about. He pretty much wrote it in his Mein Kampf thing, which was printed in the, published in the, I think, 1926 or
In the
something.
20s, yeah.
And so
From prison, if
even,
I'm not mistaken.
and so even the German political establishment didn't want Hitler. And it took a lot for the, for the rules-based global order to bring Hitler to power. It took all kinds of electioneering, and Hollywood studios came to shoot propaganda films for Hitler, and all kinds of democratic nonsense. And even at that, the best he ever did, his National Socialist Party, was 37%. That's the most votes they ever got in Germany. So it wasn't exactly like Germany was overwhelmingly in favor of Hitler, but that power transition was engineered successfully, and it's being engineered as we speak. Only a character like Hitler isn't on the horizon yet, unless it's Merz. Merz could be that person, but Merz is a deeply, deeply unpopular, probably m much more than Hitler ever was. And it remains to be seen, are they going to yield? Are they going to give up and say, okay, we have to let the people vote in the candidates that they choose, otherwise there's going to be a revolution here? Or are they going to go with heavy-handed repression and risk a revolution? It's not entirely clear, but it seems to me that the ruling establishment is desperate enough that they will risk a revolution.
Talk a little bit about France, and this was again before all this recent violence here in the US that happened. France, more or less, their government basically fell apart 2 weeks ago. And I want to say that they're going to the IMF for a loan, or they need loans from the IMF in order to stay solvent. That's not surprising, and I think we even talked about that, if I'm not mistaken. But where is that at in this cycle? And I don't see, and I could be completely wrong, but I don't see the uprisings in France as of yet, unless I just haven't seen it. But talk about France.
There have been some protests over the last week or two, but it hasn't gained momentum yet. But if they go the route of IMF loans, it's going to get worse, because
It always
IMF
does,
does
right?
IMF predictably demands these structural adjustments, which means cut back social spending, cut back infrastructure maintenance and development. Everything basically goes to servicing the debt, and then probably favoring the military industrial complex, because they are preparing for war. And so that's going to make things a whole lot worse. And the French people, I think, are already on the edge. At least 35% of all French households have difficulties making ends meet, according to the Eurostat. Life is getting increasingly difficult. Future looks increasingly bleak. Emmanuel Macron should have already gone a long time ago. People are demanding his ouster. He's extremely unpopular, and it seems to me that in France, the military and the gendarmes is a kind of police, which is something halfway between the military and police. They want Macron out, and already a few years ago, they, I think this was just before the pandemic, they sent letters, at least one, but I think two letters, to Macron to tell him, watch out, you're going to be taken down, we're going to overthrow you. It's all under the surface at the moment, but there is leadership in France that wants change, that wants end with these uncontrolled migrations, that want to return to Gaullist policies, That movement is pretty strong, but it's being repressed, of course. Well, it could be a matter of a triggering event, for that to happen. And then I don't know why particularly France tends to be also at the receiving end of repeated humiliations by the Anglo-American elites. This just keeps happening. Things like AUKUS, when the Brits and the Americans pretty much elbowed out France from their previous agreement with Australia to build them a number of diesel-powered submarines, and then their contract just got torn up and in favor of American nuclear submarines that my understanding is not only were they never delivered, it seems like they never will be delivered. But the French lost that, and that was a multi-billion dollar contract. And France got humiliated after they under Jacques Chirac they didn't support the invasion of Iraq. That was done via Haiti. The Americans brought Jean-Bertrand Aristide to power. And then, when Dominique Villepin, the foreign minister, challenged the American delegation at the UN Security Council for basically saying that the invasion of Iraq would not be justified and that France cannot support it. Well, all of a sudden, in Haiti, they started beating the drums for reparations from France to Haiti for the colonial period. And this was an amount. Which was a bizarre incident because the amount was calculated down to a cent. So it was something like $21 billion and then figures, 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 comma,
Sense.
Yes, exactly. And then France withdrew their opposition to Iraq invasion, and Jean-Bertrand Aristide was simply picked up by the CIA and flown out to, I think, Central African Republic. And that was the end of it. That was the end of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He's outlived his usefulness. French opposition was removed. And that was that. And then there was also, this, I could probably tell you 10 stories, which is very bizarre because I always assumed, there's got to be certain industrialist elites in France, and they do exist, who would push the government for some kind of an independent policy or at least a more assertive policy. But it never seems to happen. It always seems to dissipate. And I couldn't understand it until one day, a few months ago, I listened to an interview with Pepe Escobar, the Brazilian journalist. And Pepe Escobar lives in Paris. And so he's got good connections in France. And then in this interview, he says, like, everybody knows in Paris that the real boss here is Alexandre de Rothschild, the banker for.
He said that?
Yes, he said that. And I checked
Wow.
and I checked into it, and it does appear to be the case. He does wield enormous power, and he's very close with the London branch of the Rothschilds, and with certain British initiatives where Tony Blair is involved, Mr. City of London. And so that seems to check out. And so I think we have a potential explanation for that because they don't care if French industrialists lose. If everything goes tits up, well, the Rothschild bankers are going to buy everything up for pennies on the dollar, or
As they always do, they want blood, blood in the
cents on
streets.
the euros. But if the ruling establishment is so small, then they also risk to be overthrown easily, which might bring 1789 to
I
mind,
was thinking the same thing.
Yeah,
And
exactly. So I think they're in desperate straits. I think they're panicked. I think they have very bad cards to play. There's also a number of completely new circumstances in the world. One is the rise of Russia and China,
Yeah.
which are now not controlled opposition like USSR was. They are real opposition. They're not opposed to each other like USSR and China were during the Cold War. They're allied. And then there's also social media and the internet, which makes it very, very difficult for them to, concoct stories and control the narrative around whatever agenda they want through their, through their media and the television and the radio. Now they have to reckon with formats like this, where we just, talk and many people hear it and take
A
it on
hundred thousand
board.
people will listen.
There you
It's the
go. So that's a
craziest thing.
lot. And then these people will talk to their friends,
Yeah.
and their friends will talk to other friends. Somebody will check and research and say, like, oh my God, this is messed up. This can't go on like this. Whereas I think that maybe in the past, without the internet, we read the newspapers and we say, like, my gosh, the Russians are coming. We better volunteer and go to war.
Right.
And then, you manage to deflect people's genuine grievances onto an external enemy. And it's just like everything is the Russian fault. Our economy disintegrating, our elections not working, the democracy being distorted and contaminated. It's all the Russians. Look, they're flying these drones over our countries. They're attacking our elections, and they're faking the results and bringing their candidates on. We just have to go and kill Russia, right? So it seems that this is not working out for them. And you can tell that they're vexed about it because they keep talking about misinformation and disinformation and how horrible it is. And they say that it's a worse threat even than Russia itself and then global terrorism. So I think that we're doing something right, but they're never going to give up. So we can't, we can't celebrate too soon.
No, we got to keep on talking about it.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the UK, but before I do that, it was interesting, and I just thought this doesn't seem right. This is some kind of false flag, if that's the way you want to say it. You had the Russian invading, for lack of a better word, the airspace of Poland. In your mind, was that just a setup again to pull us into more potential conflict with Russia, NATO, and into potential conflict with Russia? What was that all about?
I would say that that's almost certainly what it is. If we're talking about the 13 drones, I
Yes.
don't know. Well, these were decoy drones. They're made of styrofoam, and all their all they're meant they don't carry a warhead. They don't carry surveillance equipment.
Right.
They're just meant to draw the fire from air defense missiles, so that the real drones can then strike their targets. And so these are lightweight styrofoam drones. And I think because they're so lightweight, they probably end up often falling somewhere in Ukraine with minimal damage. Maybe they get stuck in the treetops. And so
Environmental damage.
it seems to me that the Ukrainians must have scooped up a number of them. They scotched them up because you can see that they're, kept held together with duct tape. And they probably repaired them enough that they could send them over Poland to get a casus belli, to say, aha, look, Russians, Article 5, everybody, let's go to war. And so that didn't convince anybody. And so then we had well, that wasn't the first one. There was also the Russians jamming Ursula von der Leyen aircraft GPS. So the poor pilots had to use paper maps to land the aircraft, which was
Right.
horrible. And that one, I thought, deserves Article 5, but
Right.
nobody asked me. And then the other day we had three Russian military jets that spent 12 minutes allegedly in Estonian airspace. And the Russians says the Russians say no, they didn't. They were flying over to Kaliningrad, if I understood that correctly. And there's like a narrow corridor where they can fly, but the Estonians are saying they flew outside of that corridor. So that was Estonian airspace. But the Russians says no, not Russians say no, we didn't. At any rate, it would be extremely, extremely dumb of Russians to provoke anything at this stage. They're winning the war.
It's
They
like
don't need.
almost won, or should be won
Yeah,
already.
they exactly. They're basically mopping up at this stage, because Ukraine, they have almost no air force left. Their anti-air defenses are almost gone. It's just the Russians are basically mopping up the infantry at this stage, and they're gaining something like 10 to 20 square kilometers per day every day. And then the casualties on the Ukrainian side are apparently just staggering. So why would Russians now at this stage risk escalating the war that they're winning and snatch a defeat out of the jaws of victory? I think they wouldn't, but you can see how the Western powers, which used Ukraine as a proxy against the West, against Russia, are now facing defeat. So in order to avoid the defeat, they want to escalate the war to, start NATO together against Russia. And then if they manage to pull that off, then they would continue to maneuver the United States into joining them back again, because they would say like, oh, look, poor us, we are your allies, brothers, you are our daddy. You can't just let us be defeated and destroyed here. You have to join. And then, of course, with the media, with all the psychosis that goes with the war, with so many entrenched cold warriors that are still, there in the United States, in Congress, in the Pentagon, and everywhere else, they would probably exert enormous pressure for the United States to join another world war, As with World War I, Americans didn't want to go to war, but they went anyhow. World War II, Americans didn't want to go to war, but they went anyhow. And so, you can't exclude the possibility that the same thing would happen this time around again. And we know that European colonialist powers that, orchestrated the first two world wars, they have no scruples about doing whatever they need. If you need to stage a Gulf of Tonkin event, a Lusitania sinking, a Pearl Harbor, they'll do it to make sure that the United States comes back, and the daddy takes over, and then you have World War III between two nuclear powers.
So I want to work that out, but before we do that, talk about the UK. My daughter, interesting enough, she was out in Alaska working and she came back home about a week ago. And her first thing was this was after the Charlie Kirk murder assassination. She said, "Dad, do you see what's going on in the UK?" And I immediately looked it up. And this again, this is a build up, and I was aware, but they had, as far as I could see, protesters in London. And I guess what I'm wondering or talk about is this: you talked about the UK is on the brink of a civil war, and that the UK's economy imploding. Is that what this is about that we're seeing right now with all these protests?
Yeah, I think that this is what it's all about. But why the UK is on the brink of a civil war, I wouldn't know. There's clearly legitimate grievances from the British people. Life is difficult for the Brits. Taxes are going up. Social services are going away. Pressure is exerted more and more on British people, and including insane levels. I don't know if even North Korea comparison holds. People have, the police is coming to people's houses because somebody retweeted something, or because somebody's child saw a post on social media, not even retweeted, not like viewed. And so I think that people are being antagonized in a major way, maybe in order to trigger some kind of a violent reaction, because then that would give the government a justification to massively crack down on the people, to force them into 15-minute cities, to impose lockdowns, curfews, forbid gatherings, protests, whatnot, who knows. So I listened to several interviews by this social scientist, David Betts. He's American, but he teaches, I think, at King's College or London School of Economics, I forget. And his specialty is exactly these, social events and civil wars. And pretty much the quote I remember, he said that not only is a civil war likely, he said that not only UK, but other European countries are explosively configured for an outbreak of a civil war. So he was saying that it's practically inevitable that this is going to happen. Now, for a tenured professor at King's College or wherever exactly he is, that kind of statement could equally be in the same category as vaccines are safe and effective. You're going to say what they tell you to say because they want everybody to believe that, because they're preparing to crack down. So what is the real situation is difficult to know, but it's definitely not good. It's not that England is enjoying rising prosperity, good jobs, good healthcare, safe neighborhoods, good education, and so forth. It's all the opposite. The place is falling apart, and the people have had it, obviously. And then, they're gonna kick the can down the road by giving them elections, and then they're gonna, probably elect Nigel Farage. And Nigel Farage is going to deliver exactly the same policies as his Labour predecessor, which will be exactly the same policies as his Tory predecessors. It never changes. You keep electing new governments, but the policies never change. The wrapping is different, but the contents are always the same.
Was there significance, and this is going to, we'll go to the US, Middle East, and then Russia here. Was there significance with Trump visiting the crown, the UK crown, over the past week? Was it to, yeah, what was that all about? Was that to massage differences? Was that to say you're okay? Or is that, daddy showing up? What was all that about?
I don't know. I saw Trump's, I didn't hear it, I didn't listen to it, but I read Trump's address at that banquet with King Charles. And I have to say it was pretty revolting because, the United States fought its war of independence against the British Empire. It fought the 1812 war against the British Empire. British Empire was allied with the South when they tried to partition the United States into, the North and the South, make them both weakened clients of the British Empire, and then have them wage war against one another, probably in perpetuity, to keep them both weak and under control. And so to to give them this gushing speech about how wonderful the British Empire is and how their, the culture and principles are embedded in the American system and all this, it was wrong, and it was wrong at so many levels that I have to say, I've been very careful to criticize Trump. In fact, I've pretty much been very supportive of Trump on account of many of his policies that I still consider very, very positive and extremely important. But I think that here he risks demoralizing his following, because even like a lot of people who have been extremely supportive of Trump saw that stunt as a experienced it as a cold shower. And some people say that no, that was clever because he was, maybe he was how do you call it, deceiving them, maybe he was disarming them to make them believe that he's on their side, which may be, but I think that even at that speech was extremely bad and wrong at a karmic level. I don't know how to explain this exactly, but once, somebody told me this, that if you're up against a real enemy, you do not give them even an inch, particularly not at the moral level. You don't give them moral high ground. You don't bend the knee for any reason. And he just did that. So, and then, this event with Charlie Kirk.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So I want to set that up first because I not to interrupt you, but I thought it was suspicious and I don't know what to think, number one, but I'm gonna give you my suspicions and then I was like, more's gotta come out. It was really weird to me that all this stuff was written on the bullets. Just weird, right? The painting a bad guy right there. And what I've learned out throughout the many years of investing or trying to read between the tea leaves, looks like they're trying to make a bad guy.
Was it on the bullets or on the cartridges?
I believe
Do
it
you
was
know?
on the shells of the bullets.
On the shelves. So
The
it took all
shells.
this trouble. So it took all this trouble to engrave words that never even went to their target.
Exactly.
All right.
So yeah, but let's talk about that. And I also, a lot have been reporting done is about how Charlie Kirk had this has this huge organization, and I was very supportive of Charlie Kirk in the sense of getting people to talk. Let's get people to talk, like what we're doing, and let's find some answers. Change my mind, Alex, type thing. Andy, change my mind. And that's what Charlie would do. Let's talk. And then he was taken out. And he became very critical of Israel, and especially specifically Netanyahu. Go ahead and give me your thoughts.
Well, I think that it's hard to avoid the conclusion that this is a cover-up, that he was taken out by supporters of Israel. But let's put it this way, Andy. At this point, it doesn't even matter whether that's true or not. What matters is the conviction that is forming in the court of public opinion. Because it seems to me that more and more people are inclined to believe that Israel was behind his assassination for a whole host of reasons. And I think that's possible. And if you were a novice crime investigator and you look at everything that presents itself to you, you would have to say, well, I think that this is top of the list of suspects to my mind, and it will be Israel, or it will be Israeli supporters in the United States, or one of these organizations that are, Zionist agents in the United States. And it seems to me, well, maybe we'll never know, because this is one of those heavy-duty political assassinations that even the people in power might not like us to know too much about. So, it might end up like JFK assassination and RFK assassination and MLK assassination that, people are going to do research, people are going to dig up more and more and more facts. We're going to know more and more and more, but they might never be a final closure and conclusion to the case. And in that case, that's going to be very bad for Israel because at this stage, I don't even see how they're going to avoid being smeared with this forever. And so that risks to completely splinter their support base in the United States, which is my understanding about 30, 36 million, 38 million Christian evangelicals. So that's gone. And I don't really know what that means, but we had Alex Karp a few months ago saying, no, not a few months ago, maybe a year or two ago, saying that if we lose the intellectual battle, we won't be able to mobilize any army anywhere anymore. And so I think that this is what's going on. This is what's happening to them. I think that maybe they thought by eliminate that they thought that if they managed to eliminate Charlie Kirk, blame it on the transgender lefties, and slip in Ben Shapiro and pretend that they were Charlie Kirk's bestest of best friends, and that they're continuing his legacy, then maybe they would have been able to resurrect that support base. But it seems that it blew back, and I think that the result is that they're going to lose that support base completely, or to a very, very significant extent. And
Yeah, it
so,
has blown back. But then,
majorly, yes.
in but that leaves us, where is Israel now with the whole Iran conflict here? Because they're stirring up, correct me if I'm wrong, a conflict with Iran, and it seems like, and if I'm reading the tea leaves correct, the Americans have no stomach for it.
Yeah, that's clear that the Americans have no stomach for it. I've been very convinced that Trump has no intention of going to war against Iran, that he was pressured into launching a fake war against Iran in July, and that he was, his insistent that he obliterated their nuclear program was in fact him obliterating the only justification that Western powers have for going to war against Iran. Because, us being these wonderful liberal democracies all about human rights, we don't go to war to regime change countries. We go to war to prevent greater evil. So, there's this whole pretense that these Iranian mullahs are so dangerous, they must never, ever, ever be allowed to have a nuclear weapon, not even a nuclear program of any kind. And so that would then justify going to war against them. The real objective of the war was never the nuclear program, it was always a regime change. And Trump had said explicitly that he's not interested in regime change with Iran and that he wants to have better relations with Iran and do deals, which kind of makes sense since Iran is an important country in the region, very, very resource rich, has very advanced. I think Iran is one of the countries in the world that produces the most technical talent, engineers and so forth, maybe only after China. And they clearly have developed their own military hardware and technologies that are extremely powerful. So why go to war with them when you can cooperate with them? That makes sense. But then you have the Zionist Jews in the United States, and you have evangelical Christians who, that kind of thing doesn't fly. But the risk that Trump will, in some way, abandon Israel and not come to their aid if they enmesh themselves in another conflict with Iran is real. It's very real. And I think that this whole event that happened with Charlie Kirk, that gives him leeway. It gives him It gives them support to say no to Israel, which maybe didn't exist before. And I wanted to get back to Charlie Kirk assassination because something very, very extremely interesting started to emerge from that. That is this group of Netanyahu's billionaires. I have to read the article from the Gray Zone. I heard an interview with Max Blumenthal where he was talking about this. And that ties together so many things that I've observed over the past. For example, Larry Ellison, who is now
Oracle.
emerged, sorry?
Oracle, right?
Yeah, who's emerged as an arch Zionist, a huge supporter of Israel. He's now, what, he's talking about buying TikTok
Right.
and CBS. His son is buying like CBS or CNN or whatever. And they're doing this in a desperate attempt to reverse Israel's public relations losses in the United States. I didn't really realize that he was such an arch Zionist, but I did realize that he was one of the main backers of a company called Theranos, back in to 1999, 2000.
Yeah.
And he was a mentor to Elizabeth Holmes.
No kidding.
Yeah, I'm dead serious. And I looked into the case of Theranos, and I wrote a series of articles and a little video presentation about it. And once you dig into the case, you realize that this whole thing was a mega fraud,
Right.
and that the only justifiable reason for them to even set up Theranos was to use it as an information weapon for future pandemics. Okay. And the people who were on the board of directors of Theranos were
Huge
practically
players. Huge players.
huge players, nobody from the healthcare industry,
From like the State Department.
everybody from the deep state,
Yeah.
Pentagon, State Department, Henry Kissinger, George Shultz,
Schultz.
General
Yes.
Shultz, General
Yeah.
Mattis. I have that. I have that presentation somewhere
That's
on
a
my website.
great point.
And then, I posted something about this on X, and then somebody replied with a photograph of Larry Ellison with Tony Blair in a casual setting on a speedboat somewhere. I thought, this is all the same. These are all the same people.
Right?
It keeps, like, you pull any thread from this morass that the world is in, and you pull it out, and it leads to one of these ghouls.
Yeah.
So, and then you find out they own or control all these strategic assets in the United States. How did that happen?
Right.
Another major supporter of Theranos was Rupert Murdoch.
Okay.
Rupert Murdoch, who controls Wall Street Journal
Media.
and a whole bunch of media
Fox.
in the
Yep.
United States. And so it seems that this is exactly this, not I shouldn't call them the Imperial Cabal, because the Imperial Cabal is way up there.
But it's an
But
oligarchy.
this is their equestrian class, the people who are what Ian Burlingame calls it, the managerial class.
Yeah.
Right,
Right.
but it's very small, and Tony Blair is in everything. Like almost every thread leads to Tony Blair. And who's Tony Blair? Tony Blair is the knight companion of the most noble order of the Garter, like the highest level knighthood order of the City of London. And Keir Starmer is his stupid minion. Keir Starmer
Yeah.
is there as an empty suit. The Eminence Grise is always Tony Blair behind everything. So I
Interesting.
would, like, that would be that cabal would be at the top of the list of my suspects for some enhanced interrogation to
Right.
find out what's going on.
So let's pivot to America here. You mentioned in at the start of this conversation, Europe going to war, and really Israel going to war. It's really going to dependent on America. I guess what I'm saying is, work that out for me. And what is your expectation?
Sorry, Andy, I missed the question. What is exactly the question?
Well, when we first started talking, we were talking about Europe going to war, and that's going to be somewhat. Or the EU going to war, NATO going to war, and that's going to be somewhat dependent on the US.
Right.
Yeah, work that out for me, as well as it seems like Israel, attacking Iran or wh whoever else in the Middle East, that would be dependent on the US. What is your expectation with that, and how is that going to be worked out? And if you want to
Well,
hold
okay,
on just for a
before.
second, hold on just for a second. Okay. Yeah, if you can work that out for me.
Yeah, well, before I get into that, I want to say that even if the United States, comes guns blazing on the side of the European colonial powers and on the Western empire side, doesn't mean that the empire prevails. I think it still goes down in flames. It would just take the
Great
United
point.
States,
I do too.
it
Great
would
point.
still take the United States along with it. And so we see that Donald Trump has been adamant that he's done with Project Ukraine, that he's not going to back Europeans if they choose to go to war against Russia. He's declined to give Ukraine a security guarantee, which is absolutely critical and hugely important moment in world history. But the problem is that Donald Trump is one guy who could be assassinated, who could be maneuvered into going against his better judgment. And w what I mean by that is, something that emerged with this Charlie Kirk assassination is that, and this is also through Max Blumenthal, who is crediting this to multiple sources from out of the White House, and who said that Trump is actually very afraid of the Israelis, of
I heard the same
Benjamin
thing.
Netanyahu, that he is afraid of assassination, which is entirely possible. He wouldn't be the first president to be assassinated. So if Trump is the obstruction to their agenda, then they might try to remove him, and if they're successful, then they're going to take the United States to war, World War III. And then, all bets are off, because we might we might burn to a crisp in a nuclear holocaust, because we're talking about two nuclear superpowers who have meanwhile removed all obstacles to the use of nuke. George W. Bush walked out unilaterally from the nuclear arms treaty, ABM treaty, anti-ballistic missile treaty, in 2003. And then Trump, which is one of his big, huge mistakes, he walked out in 2019 from the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. And so now there's hardly any controls left, and American nuclear doctrine is to always be on hair trigger alert. Who knows? So I think that I don't know where Trump is at. Some people are saying that his administration has been overrun by Zionists. I heard people say it's been overrun by the British. Same thing, essentially. It all leads to the City of London in the end. Anyhow, Zionism is a project of the British Empire, and they never distance themselves. They're still very, very deeply involved with Israel and in Israel. So And then somebody said that he's simply given up. Somebody said that Trump has pretty much capitulated, has given up. He can't, he couldn't take the pressure anymore. Others say that no, he's faking that. He's going to hit them hard again. I don't know what to believe. The blizzard of psyops is so intense that I sometimes then go and I read what the British are saying, and if they're still hysterical about Trump, I take that as a reassurance. Then I read what the Russians are saying about Trump, and if they're still positive and optimistic about US-Russian relation, I take that as a reassurance. So far, so good. We're there. The Brits are still hostile, the Russians are still positive. And so I hope that Trump's initial commitments and his initial inclinations will persist and persevere. And I do believe that the tragedy of Charlie Kirk's assassination probably helps in that sense. But if he's taken out, then there's no telling what happens next. And World War III is much, much more likely in that case. Because even if the American people don't want to go to war, they didn't want to go to war the first time around, the First World War. They didn't want to go to the Second World War. They might be dragged kicking and screaming into World War III. So I think we're really coming to a time when people have to be on alert, and they have to be very determined, because there's going to be a lot of propaganda. There's going to be a lot of coercion to go come to the aid of our European allies. And you can see how the propaganda in favor of Ukraine has just gone on off all cylinders. It's everywhere. It's super intense. And you have to tell yourself, okay, I'm being propagandized. I don't want to go there. I don't want to do this, because I'm going to leave my children a planet burnt down. So whatever the propaganda, whatever emotional buttons they're pushing for you, never, ever, ever agree to go into World War III for any reason. It's only serving the interests of the imperial cabal in the city of London, in Paris, on Wall Street, etc. It doesn't serve any of our purposes at all.
Well said, very well said. And I think it's almost like this is a public service, just having these conversations, just to get it out. As we only have that big of a slice of the world, if you would, but just do what we can, just getting out how we see the world, and to not get dragged into something like this.
Yeah, I think it's important that we do what we can, because, in the end, it's in God's hands, but we have to do our best to make sure
Fuel the machine.
we didn't stay silent, and how do you call it, acquiesce to these degenerates that are taking us to perdition.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Alex, we're going to end on that. Can you give me your Substack? And I am embarrassed to say to all my viewers and listeners, I've known Alex for almost a year now. I've been a huge fan. I have not, Alex, I have not subscribed to your Substack as a paying member, but I will as soon as we're done. I've been meaning to do that, but the world has been chaos. And I mean that, I want to support you in any way that I can.
Don't
But
worry
how
about it, Andy. Thank you anyway.
I would
It's
love to,
my so
though. It's my
I have
pleasure.
two Substacks. I have two publications on Substack. One of them is a daily newsletters for daily newsletter for investors and traders, with trend following signals, so for about 18 global markets, including gold and Bitcoin. It's called iSystem Trend Compass. Then I also have my personal publication called Alex Craner's Substack, which is I publish there a bit less frequently, but I try to make the article a bit more thoroughly researched and more refined, which is hard to do on a daily basis. And then sorry. And then I'm also active on X, My handle is at Naked Hedgie. And then from there you find everything else, but these are the main three.
Yeah, Alex, I'll put all of this in the show notes as I do every single time, and I'll be a very proud supporter of you and your work. You do a great job. I want to thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you very much, Andy. That's very kind. Always good to join you, and warm greetings to your audience.
Thank you so much. We'll have you on again soon.
Pleasure. Take care.
Take care.